welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. By many accounts, the undersupply of affordable and quality housing has reached a crisis point in the United States. My guests today are an editor and contributor to a new book on housing and affordability titled Housing the Nation, Social Equity, Architecture, and the Future of Affordable Housing. Victoria Newhouse is one of the book's editors and is an architectural historian and the founder of the Architectural History Foundation. Michael Geekin is a senior advisor to the Industrial Areas Foundation, and both of them have published widely in the field. Victoria, Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting us.
Well, it's great to have you on here. And let me just say at the beginning, maybe I haven't read enough books that concern architecture and design, but I have to say, in addition to the content, the book itself is gorgeous, just the way that you've designed the notes, where they appear, the use of the photographs and the case studies and examples, all the aspects are just very aesthetically pleasing. So congratulations to you on that, in addition to the content. So let me just start with a basic question. Victoria, I'll start with you on this one. We have, obviously, as I mentioned at the beginning, we've heard increasingly about the problem of affordable housing in the United States, and also affordable and architecturally interesting housing. Can you just give us an idea of the extent of the current problem in the United States at present? I mean, how bad has this become, maybe in comparison to our past, or, you know, in comparison to anything else that you think it's relevant to?
Well, I think it's as bad as it could possibly be, frankly, because there's well over 500,000 people who remain homeless in the United States each year. And you mentioned before you started recording our talk that Syracuse has a problem with housing, affordable housing, and you are not alone. This is a problem that is absolutely pervasive, even in rural areas, which has rarely been the case before. In fact, we have one chapter that's written by architects who work in Arkansas, and the problem is just as dire there as it is in the cities. So it really is extremely serious and needing fixing. You people are very lucky in having this enormous micron project planned, and that I think you should be very grateful for that, because I think it's going to be a tremendous help.
Well, we are excited about it, and that is one of the things that I wanted to ask the two of you about a little bit later on in the conversation. You know, you mentioned that it's a problem in rural areas, and you anticipated one of the questions that I wanted to ask about that. I just know I'm more familiar, for example, with Vermont, and I know that in Vermont, particularly for renters, it's very difficult problem. But Michael, on that issue, I mean, it is something that we normally, if you would ask most people, I think they would immediately think of urban areas. But can you speak to like certain types of areas or parts of the country where we tend to see this more than others?
Well, in almost every major city, it's obviously a challenge. But I've spent a lot of time in rural southern Ohio, West Virginia, northern Kentucky. And you go into a small town, and there's just simply no housing being built. And in fact, many of the people who live in those towns are living in trailers that were never meant to be 40 or 50 year residences, and are now all in need of upgrading or replacement, probably. There's a town called The Plains, just outside of Athens, Ohio. And there's an area of trailer homes that once were perfectly good for the families that live there, and now are all sagging and falling apart. So this is across the board, as Victoria said. This is an urban, rural, and even now some of the older suburbs are experiencing the lack of affordable housing. I think it was Freddie Mac that did a study that said the nation is about 3.8 million starter homes short right now, and that number keeps climbing. A starter home being something in the area of a 1,400 to 1,500 square foot home. And unless we build those homes, what we used to call working class Americans are never going to be able to enter the housing market. There's no way in right now. And this is across the board.
So let me follow up with you on that. And Victoria, if you want to jump in on this too, after Michael speaks to it. But Victoria, you know, you mentioned Syracuse, and you're right. We have an issue with affordable housing definitely here. And by some measures, it's one of the starkest in the country. And I wanted to place this in the context, I guess, of my own history here. I remember when I first came to Syracuse 30 plus years ago, one of the selling points for the job was that housing was inexpensive to purchase. And that was one of the things that my colleagues said to me, but now Syracuse has an affordable housing crunch. So even though you're not necessarily an expert on Syracuse, is there a trajectory that cities like Syracuse, Michael, have followed in the last several decades that have produced this problem? You mentioned the absence of construction. Is that the driver, the lack of a denominator there, or what is the problem?
There's several factors, Grant, but one is I did a piece for the Boston Review about several books written about community development in Boston. The average white family in Boston has about $250,000 in wealth. The average black family has $8. And Boston has a robust rental affordable housing system, but no ownership, home ownership, condo ownership culture. And the reason is the whole country has kind of drifted into housing production financed by low-income housing tax credits. And we're for them. It's a good tool, but it's become in many places the only tool because the financing has been available for that. And it's been harder for cities and counties and rural areas to figure out how to build starter ownership housing so that people can begin to build equity. And that for us has been a kind of a keystone concept from day one.
And I'd just like to add that, you know, up until the Nixon administration, there was federal funding for affordable housing. And under the Nixon administration, that came to an end. So we're left with these tax credits, as Mike has just said, and tremendous inequity between wealth and less well-to-do people. Much too much of a gap between people who have means and people who do not have means. And as Mike mentioned, the black population is particularly suffering under this.
One of the things that we do know about socioeconomics in the United States in the last 40 or 50 years is that there has been growing inequality. So it sounds like this is a story that parallels that in a lot of ways. Michael, is that true?
Yes. 60% of the wealth of most Americans, other than very wealthy Americans, is in their house, is in the equity they patiently build. And like you, Grant, my wife and I moved to Queens in 1980, and we bought a house for $49,500, you know, and we had to borrow money from our father-in-law to even get started. But thank God we did, because we were able to buy another house. We were able to move at some point. Most Americans, particularly people of color, don't have that house anymore. There's no $49,500 house, the equivalent in current rates for people. And therefore, they never enter the market and never begin to build equity. So all the talk of social equity has to be balanced by some talk of the economic equity that's being deprived because of no productive housing system right now.
And I'd like to add something to that. You know, what we try to do in the book is give an overall picture of many of the problems. And it's not one simple problem. We have a problem of increased construction costs, for example, with very, very little experimentation with new materials like timber, timber and varieties of timber, and tremendous what we are calling system breakdown. Like, for example, one example of this is zoning. We need to rezone, as you have, I understand. I did a little reading about Syracuse and what's happening there, and I understand that Syracuse rezoned, and that has allowed a great many possibilities, and many more communities need to do that, and on and on and on. I mean, this is so complex, and it needs to really, people need to work together. I mean, now you have in different cities a half a dozen or a dozen different agencies all trying to accomplish something, and it's just not working because it's not being coordinated. Houston is one example of an exception to that, where they did manage to gather together everybody who is working on this problem under one agency who led the whole effort, and more communities need to do that.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about some positive examples a little bit later, you know, and you mentioned the zoning, Victoria. It is true that we are looking at changing that, but it has been extremely controversial, as you might imagine, particularly in some of the suburbs, including one that I happen to live in, that have resisted that pressure from above and from the city to change that. And so it's been a real challenge. So there's another question that's related to this in some ways, and that is the relationship between housing prices for buying houses, you know, Michael, what you were talking about with the starter homes, and rents. And the assumption, I think, again, is that those things always tend to follow the same paths, but can those two things be subject to different forces, whereas one gets out of whack with the other depending on what the supply is? Can either of you speak to that?
Mike, I think you can more than
scarcity is the enemy of affordability, and we have tremendous scarcity on the ownership side and on the starter home side. I hate to keep beating the same drum, but I think it's fundamental to the problem we have. And because there's scarcity, obviously there are fewer homes, there's more competition, the costs that keep going up. And we see this dramatically in the home ownership portion of the housing market. A little more production on the rental side, both market and affordable, as I mentioned. But still high there. What we always say, what we learned in East Brooklyn and the South Bronx, is if you're going to rebuild at scale. So we build 1,000 homes at a time, for example. And when you build 1,000 homes at a time, when you negotiate with your contractors and your labor unions, you have more leverage. You're offering a 1,000 home project, not a 10 home project. So we can drive costs down. We can get many efficiencies you can't get on smaller projects. So part of the challenge is to think at a larger scale about how to rebuild and recreate kind of an affordable ownership market as well as a rental market. You need both.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Victoria Newhouse and Michael Geekin. They are housing experts, and we've been discussing their new book, which is titled Housing the Nation: Social Equity, Architecture, and the Future of Affordable Housing. So, Victoria, you mentioned in the first half of the program, Syracuse and Micron. And so you've heard about this microchip maker that's committed to making a huge new manufacturing investment in the Syracuse area over the next 10 years. And it's likely to transform the economy and obviously grow the area dramatically, both in terms of population and in terms of overall income and wages. One concern that this development is raising among some folks is what it will do to the availability of affordable housing to accommodate the growth, and what it will do to the folks who are already here, who are at low incomes. And so I guess the question that I have for you is, given the legacy of a city like Syracuse and now this new development, are there any best practices or things that might have come out of the book or elsewhere that you think should inform the way this community goes about approaching this and thinking about it?
Well, you mentioned that there's some resistance to the effort to rezone. Mm-hmm. And of course, we have encountered that in a number of communities, the NIMBY, yeah. Not in my backyard. And of course, these people who resist change are concerned with their own finances, and they're afraid that changes could affect the value of their own properties. And there's not much that I can say about that, except that I think, you know, people have to have a more humane attitude and be more open-minded. There's also, I've noticed in some of the publications about what's going on in Syracuse, a fear of gentrification.
Yes.
Which of course is it naturally, it's a fear. When any amount of when some enormous amounts of money are invested, and it's something that has to be watched. I encountered this in research I did a few years ago in Detroit, and that's a city that has perhaps more problems than any other city that I know of in the U.S. And that was at the top of their list of concerns, that it has to be watched and controlled. I remember that Maurice Cox, the very, very brilliant head of urban planning in Detroit at that time, stopped development along the riverside. Some of the demolition of industrial buildings opened up the riverside, which was extremely beautiful. And of course, developers rushed in and wanted to develop. And he just put his foot down and stopped it and would not allow it, because he realized that this would involve gentrification.
Hmm. And a related question, and Michael, this goes to your wheelhouse from Industrial Areas Foundation. And I just want to say, too, by the way, I want to put a plug in for your organization for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with it. But it's a very important organization that does really important work in communities all around the country. But when you have a company like Micron that is the size of it, and they are coming into a community like Syracuse, and they're talking about $100 billion of investment, which rivals the economy. There's obviously a concern beyond the gentrification that this company is going to just wield an enormous amount of power in all aspects of public life. One time I was talking to someone and I used the analogy of the tail wagging the dog, and I had to correct myself. It's not clear to me what the dog and the tail are in this instance. So, from your experience as, you know, working in communities through IAF, are there certain strategies that you would recommend that communities should follow, or things they should be most worried about to avoid when something like this? It's a good problem to have, obviously, but at the same time, you know, it does create some concerns for over-control.
Yeah, you know, the key is that there has to be effective local organizing that takes place among the churches, the synagogues, mosques, other institutions, unless there's what we call a third sector, not government, not the market, unless there's what Peter Drucker called the third sector, the voluntary sector, unless there's a power center in the third sector. It's very hard to negotiate with, Micron or with anybody. So the first challenge is just something that people need to grapple with locally. And there are many good advocates and activists out there, but the key is engaging the mixed middle, the people who maybe don't identify so much as activists or don't identify so much on either extreme, but who are living their lives, working hard, making Syracuse and the suburbs of Syracuse their home. How do you engage them and bring them together? So that's number one. And number two is you've got to play offense. You can't just play defense against a project like this. You've got to have your own imagination and picture of what you want Syracuse to look like. And envision, all these are words of the eye, by the way. And that's why Victoria and Alex Gorlin, I thought, as you mentioned, did such a great job. This is a beautifully visual book, but housing is visual and community building is visual. And people have to have a picture of what they want to build, whole neighborhoods, whole communities, whole areas. So no one can stop that from happening. If there's local leadership there that sees that as their job in the next several years. But it's a great opportunity. Look, at every lots of communities would love to have that challenge, frankly.
Yeah, and the single biggest concern, which I think has been largely addressed at this point, is given Syracuse's recent history with other big projects, not nearly the size of this one, that didn't pan out. The worry was it won't happen, but it seems like Micron has already made upfront investments, and there are a lot of, from President Biden on down to the county executive people, that have got a lot of political capital invested in making this pan out. Victoria, on the issue of affordable housing and architecture, I'm assuming this is probably something that is near and dear to your heart, but I think there's an assumption that affordable housing has to be uninteresting, and affordable housing even has to be ugly architecturally. And your book is a very persuasive denial of that, but I wanted to know if you wanted to speak to that issue more generally.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the compliment about our argument regarding aesthetics. And yes, absolutely. Alex Gorlin, my co-editor, is an architect, and he has designed and built a great deal of affordable housing, all of which is really quite attractive, as are the other projects that we published. In the back of the book, we have what we call a portfolio, which is designed to persuade people that, as you said, affordable housing can be very attractive. I mean, the days of Pruitt-Igoe that was torn down because it was so ugly and so unsuccessful are gone. I mean, nobody builds anything that looks like that anymore. And there is tremendous talent going into the design of affordable housing. And I have been in a number of buildings that offer this kind of affordable residence. And they're very attractive. I mean, I could easily live in any one of them. So it's also what is not widely known, supportive housing, which is affordable buildings where the whole ground floor is devoted to offices designed to help the people living in that building, help find jobs, help find medical help, and on and on, all sorts of various needs, which is an added plus.
And that sounds like that goes beyond what we often hear of multi-purpose, but you're actually using that ground floor to support the people living above.
That's
directly, right?
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Yes.
Interesting. So we've got about 3 minutes left or so, and I wanted to leave time for both of you to reflect on this issue that it seems to me the book brings together, and that is the role for design. I mean, this is a rather abstract question, but the role for design and architecture and social policy and social advocacy and social justice, as well as aesthetics, all coming together to kind of make our lives better. And I wanted to give both of you a chance to say, are there things that you'd want to leave our listeners with on thinking about all of those things at the same time, that as Syracuse thinks about Micron and housing, it should keep in mind. I don't know who, if either of you want to jump in first on this, but some relatively brief thoughts on this.
Do you want to start, Mike?
Sure. I think people have to envision what they want to build, literally. Mm-hmm. Now, all these vision, imagination, insight, foresight, these are all words of the eye. So not just buildings, as I mentioned, but their neighborhoods. How do they envision them being rebuilt? And working hard at that so that they're not just reacting to other people's plans, they're promoting and proposing plans that they favor. So I think that's a challenge for everybody, and it's a good challenge. And then the other thing is, I would just urge people to think at a bigger scale, to think about the Micron situation is an opportunity to rebuild Syracuse for working people, as well as for the higher income folks who might end up working at Micron. Take advantage of that opportunity.
I'm sorry, Victoria. Let me just follow up quickly on something, Michael, and then we'll get you. I was just going to say we sponsored an event related to these topics, and one of the speakers did hit on that, is that thinking beyond Micron, thinking about the other things that might come in. Yeah. I'm sorry, Victoria, but go ahead. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, but I think that's a very good point. I think there's a need for transparency, I think, and openness between people and discussion. I think the more discussion that can be organized and help people to understand the problems, I think the better.
Those are both wise things to end on. We'll have to leave it there. That was Victoria Newhouse and Michael Geekin. And again, their new book is titled Housing the Nation, Social Equity, Architecture, and the Future of Affordable Housing. It's an important book, and it is a beautiful book, I have to say. So, Michael, Victoria, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me, and thanks for doing the book.
Thank you, Grant, and good luck with all your wonderful plans.
Yeah, thanks, Grant.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, is hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio. Assistant producer is Jacqueline Witwicky, and the program is edited by Mark Lefonier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program and hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.